But it goes against a basic element of human nature. To have deeper levels of pleasure, we have to learn to limit ourselves. Reading a variety of books for entertainment in rapid succession leads to a diminishing sense of satisfaction with each book. Our minds are overwhelmed and overstimulated, and we must reach for a new one right away. Reading one excellent book and absorbing ourselves in it has a relaxing and uplifting effect as we discover hidden riches within it. In the moments when we are not reading, we think of the book again and again. All of us require pleasurable moments outside work, ways to relieve our tension, but when we operate with a sense of purpose, we know the value of limiting ourselves, opting for depth of experience rather than overstimulation. Causes and cults. People have a profound need to believe in something, and in the absence of great unifying belief systems, this void is easily filled by all kinds of micro-causes and cults. We notice that such groups tend not to last very long. Within 10 years, they already seem passé. During their brief existence, their adherents will substitute extreme conviction and hyper-belief for a clear vision of what they are after. For this purpose, enemies are quickly found and are said to be the source of all that is wrong in the world. Such groups become the means for people to vent their personal frustrations, envy, and hatred. They also get to feel superior, as part of some clique with special access to the truth. We can recognize a micro-cause or cult by the vagueness of what its disciples want. They cannot describe the kind of world or society they desire in concrete, practical terms. Much of their raison d'être revolves around negative definitions. Get rid of these people or those practices and the world will become a paradise. They have no sense of strategy or defined ways of reaching their nebulous goals, which is a clear sign that their group is merely about the release of emotions. Often such groups will depend on large public gatherings in which people can become intoxicated by numbers and shared feelings. Wily rulers throughout history have used this to great effect. People in a crowd are highly suggestible. Through short, simple phrases with lots of repetition, they can be made to chant back slogans and swallow the most absurd and irrational ideas. In a crowd, people can feel relieved of any personal responsibility, which can lead to violence. They feel transported beyond themselves and not so puny. But such enlargement is an illusion. They are actually made smaller by losing their will and their individual voice. Allying ourselves with a cause can be an important part of our sense of purpose, as it was for Martin Luther King Jr., but it must emerge from an internal process in which we have thought deeply about the subject and are committing ourselves to the cause as part of our life's work. We are not simply a cog in the machinery of such a group, but active contributors, bringing our uniqueness into play and not mimicking the company line. We are not joining out of a need to gratify our ego or to vent ugly emotions, but rather out of a hunger for justice and truth that springs from deep within our own sense of purpose. Money and success. For many people, the pursuit of money and status can supply them with plenty of motivation and focus. Such types would consider figuring out their calling in life a monumental waste of time and an antiquated notion. But in the long run, this philosophy often yields the most impractical of results. First, more often than not, such types enter the field in which they can make the most money the fastest. They aim for the biggest paychecks. Their career choices have slight or no connection to their actual inclinations. The fields they choose will tend to be crowded with other insatiable hunters of money and success, and so the competition is fierce. If they are zealous enough, they might do quite well for a while. But as they get older, they begin to feel restless and ever so slightly bored. They try different avenues for money and success. They need new challenges. They have to keep finding ways to motivate themselves. Often they make big mistakes in their obsessive pursuit of money because their thinking is so short-term, as we saw with those who went all in on the derivatives frenzy leading up to the crash of 2008. Second, money and success that last come from remaining original and not mindlessly following the path that others are following. If we make money our primary goal, we never truly cultivate our uniqueness, and eventually someone younger and hungrier will supplant us. And finally, what often motivates people in this quest is to simply have more money and status than other people, and to feel superior. With that standard, it is difficult to know when they have enough, because there are always people with more. And so the quest is endless and exhausting. And since the connection to their work is not personal, such people become alienated from themselves. The pursuit feels soulless. They are workaholics without a true calling. They may become depressed or manic, and they will often lose what they have gained if they become manic enough. We all know the effects of hyper-intention. If we want and need desperately to sleep, we are less likely to fall asleep. If we absolutely must give the best talk possible at some conference, we become hyper-anxious about the result and the performance suffers. If we desperately need to find an intimate partner or make friends, we are more likely to push them away. If instead we relax and focus on other things, we are more likely to fall asleep or give a great talk or charm people. The most pleasurable things in life occur as a result of something not directly intended and expected. When we try to manufacture happy moments, they tend to disappoint us. The same goes for the dogged pursuit of money and success. Many of the most successful, famous, and wealthy individuals do not begin with an obsession with money and status. One prime example would be Steve Jobs, who amassed quite a fortune in his relatively short life. He actually cared very little for material possessions. His singular focus was on creating the best and most original designs, and when he did so, good fortune followed him. Concentrate on maintaining a high sense of purpose, and the success will flow to you naturally. Attention. People have always pursued fame and attention as a way to feel enlarged and more important. They become dependent on the number of people applauding, the size of the army they command, the crowd of courtiers that serve them. But this false sense of purpose has become greatly democratized and widespread through social media. Now almost any one of us can have the quantity of attention that past kings and conquerors could only dream about. Our self-image and self-esteem become tied to the attention we receive on a daily basis. In social media, this often requires becoming increasingly outrageous to capture eyeballs. It is an exhausting and alienating quest as we become more of a clown than anything else. And each moment that the attention ebbs ever so slightly, a gnawing pain eats away at us. Are we losing it? Who is siphoning off the flow of attention that was ours? As with money and success, we have a much greater chance of attracting attention by developing a high sense of purpose and creating work that will naturally draw people to it. When the attention is unexpected, as with the success we suddenly have, it is all the more pleasurable. Cynicism. According to Friedrich Nietzsche, man would rather have the void as purpose than be void of purpose. Cynicism, the feeling that there is no purpose or meaning in life, is what we shall call having the void as purpose. In the world today, with growing disenchantment with politics and the belief systems of the past, this form of the false purpose is becoming increasingly common. Such cynicism involves some or all of the following beliefs. Life is absurd, meaningless, and random. Standards of truth, excellence, or meaning are completely old-fashioned. Everything is relative. People's judgments are simply interpretations of the world. None better than another. All politicians are corrupt, so it's not really worth it to get involved. Better to abstain or choose a leader who will deliberately tear it all down. People who are successful get there through gaming the system. Any form of authority should be naturally mistrusted. Look behind people's motives and you will see that they are selfish. Reality is quite brutal and ugly. Better to accept this and be skeptical. It's really hard to take anything so seriously. We should just laugh and have a good time. It's all the same. This attitude presents itself as cool and hip. Its adherents display a somewhat apathetic and sardonic air that gives them the appearance that they see through it all. But the attitude is not what it seems. Behind it is the adolescent pose of appearing to not care, which disguises a great fear of trying and failing, of standing out and being ridiculed. It stems from sheer laziness and offers its believers consolation for their lack of accomplishments. As hunters for purpose and meaning, we want to move in the opposite direction. Reality is not brutal and ugly. It contains much that is sublime, beautiful, and worthy of wonder. We see this in the great works of other achievers. We want to have more encounters with the sublime. Nothing is more awe-inspiring than the human brain itself, its complexity, its untapped potential. We want to realize some of that potential in our lives, not wallow in the cynical slacker attitude. We see a purpose behind everything that we experience and see. In the end, what we want is to fuse the curiosity and excitement we had toward the world as children, when almost everything seemed enchanting, with our adult intelligence. The whole law of human existence consists in nothing other than a man's always being able to bow before the immeasurably great. If people are deprived of the immeasurably great, they will not live and will die in despair. The immeasurable and infinite are as necessary for man as the small planet he inhabits. Fyodor Dostoevsky. Chapter 14. Resist the downward pull of the group. The law of conformity. We have a side to our character that we are generally unaware of, our social personality, the different person we become when we operate in groups of people. In the group setting, we unconsciously imitate what others are saying and doing. We think differently, more concerned with fitting in and believing what others believe. We feel different emotions, infected by the group mood. We are more prone to taking risks, to acting irrationally because everyone else is. This social personality can come to dominate who we are. Listening so much to others and conforming our behavior to them, we slowly lose a sense of our uniqueness and the ability to think for ourselves. The only solution is to develop self-awareness and a superior understanding of the changes that occur in us in groups. With such intelligence, we can become superior social actors, able to outwardly fit in and cooperate with others on a high level while retaining our independence and rationality. An experiment in human nature. As a young boy growing up in communist China, Gao Jianhua, born 1952, dreamed of becoming a great writer. He loved literature, and his teachers commended him for his essays and poems. In 1964, he gained admittance to the Yizhen Middle School, YMS, not far from where his family lived. Located in the town of Yizhen, several hundred miles north of Beijing, YMS was labeled a key school. Over 90% of its students went on to college. It was difficult to get into and quite prestigious. At YMS, Jianhua was a quiet and studious boy. He had ambitions of graduating in 6 years with a top record, good enough to get into Beijing University, from where he would launch the writing career he dreamed about. Students at YMS lived on campus, and life there could be rather dull since the Communist Party regulated almost every aspect of life in China, including education. There were daily military drills, propaganda classes, manual labor duty, and regular classes, which could be rigorous. At YMS, Jianhua developed a close friendship with a classmate named Fang Pu, perhaps the most zealous communist at school. Pale and thin and wearing glasses, Fang Pu looked the type of the intellectual revolutionary. He was 4 years older than Jianhua, but they had bonded over their common love of literature and their desire to become writers. They had their differences. Fang Pu's poetry centered on political issues. He worshipped Chairman Mao Zedong and wanted to emulate not only his writings, but also his revolutionary career. Jianhua, on the other hand, had little interest in politics, even though his father was a respected communist war veteran and government official. But they enjoyed their literary discussions, and Fang Pu treated Jianhua like a younger brother. In May of 1966, as Jianhua was engrossed in his studies, preparing for the final exams to end his second year, Fang Pu paid him a visit, and he seemed unusually animated. He had been scouring the Beijing newspapers to keep up with trends in the capital, and recently he had read of a literary debate started by several renowned intellectuals that he had to share with Jianhua. These intellectuals had accused well-known, respected writers of hiding counter-revolutionary messages in their plays, films, and magazine articles. They based these accusations on careful readings of certain passages in the writer's work that could be seen as veiled criticisms of Mao himself. "Certain people are using art and literature to attack the party and socialism," said Fang Pu. "This debate is about the future of the revolution," he said, "and Mao must be behind it all." To Jianhua, it all seemed a bit tedious and academic, but he trusted his older friend's instincts, and he promised to follow the events in the newspaper. Fang Pu's words proved prophetic. Within a week, papers throughout China had picked up the story of the raging debate. Teachers at YMS began to talk about some of the newspaper articles in their classes. One day, the school's Communist Party secretary, a paunchy man named Ding Yi, called for an assembly and gave a speech recounting almost verbatim an editorial against the counter-revolutionary writers. Something was definitely in the air. The students now had to devote so many hours every day to discussing the latest turns in the debate. Throughout Beijing, posters with large headlines had appeared everywhere attacking the anti-party black line, meaning those who were secretly trying to put the brakes on the communist revolution. Ding supplied the students with materials for making their own posters, and the students happily threw themselves into the task. They largely copied the posters from Beijing. Jianhua's friend, Zong Wei, a talented artist, made the most attractive posters of all, with his elegant calligraphy. Within days, almost all of the walls of the school were covered with posters, and Secretary Ding roamed around the campus, reading them, smiling and approving of the work. To Jianhua, it was all quite novel and exciting, and he loved the new look of the campus walls. The campaign in Beijing focused on local intellectuals everyone knew, but in Yizhen, this seemed rather distant. If China was being infiltrated by all kinds of counter-revolutionaries, that meant that they had also probably infiltrated the school itself, and the only logical place for the students to look for such class enemies was among their teachers and school officials. They began to scrutinize their lectures and lessons for hidden messages, much as the intellectuals had done with the work of famous writers. The geography teacher, Liu, always talked about the beautiful landscapes of China, but hardly ever mentioned the inspiring words of Mao. Could that mean something? The physics teacher, Feng, had an American father who had served in the U.S. Navy. Was he secretly an imperialist? Li, the teacher of Chinese, had fought initially on the side of the nationalists against the communists during the revolution, but in the last year had switched sides. The students had always trusted his version of events, and he was Jianhua's favorite teacher because he had such a flair for telling stories. But in retrospect, he seemed a bit old-fashioned and bourgeois. Could he still be a counter-revolutionary nationalist at heart? Soon, a few posters appeared that questioned the fervor of some of these teachers. Secretary Ding found this a trivial application of the debate, and he ordered a ban on all posters attacking teachers. By June, the movement sweeping Beijing and soon all of China had acquired a name: the Great Socialist Cultural Revolution. It was indeed Mao himself who had instigated it all by setting up the newspaper articles, and he was to be the ongoing leader of the new movement. He feared that China had been slipping back into its feudal past. Old ways of thinking and acting had returned. Bureaucracies had become breeding grounds for a new type of elite. Peasants remained relatively powerless. He wanted a wake-up call to revive the revolutionary spirit. He wanted the younger generation to experience revolution firsthand by making it themselves. He proclaimed to young people that it was right to rebel, but the word he used in Chinese for this was Zaofan, which literally means to turn everything upside down. It was young people's duty, he said, to question authority. Those who secretly worked to pull China back into its past he called revisionists, and he implored students to help him uncover the revisionists and root them out of the new revolutionary China. Taking these pronouncements of Mao as a call to action, Fang Pu created the most audacious poster anyone had yet seen. It was a direct attack on Secretary Ding himself. Ding was not only the school's party secretary, but also a veteran of the revolution and a highly respected figure. According to Fang Pu, however, his prohibition on criticizing teachers proved he was a revisionist, bent on suppressing the questioning spirit Mao had encouraged. This created quite a stir. The students had been reared to unquestioningly obey those in authority, particularly respected party members. Fang Pu had broken this taboo. Had he gone too far? A few days after the appearance of Fang Pu's poster, some strangers arrived on campus from Beijing. They were part of work teams sent to schools around China to help supervise and maintain some discipline over the burgeoning Cultural Revolution. The work team at YMS ordered Fang Pu to publicly apologize to Secretary Ding. At the same time, however, they lifted the ban on posters that criticized teachers. As in schools around China, they also suspended all classes and exams at YMS. Students were to devote themselves to making revolution under their watchful eye. Suddenly feeling free of the yoke of the past and all the habits of obedience drummed into them, the students at YMS began to brazenly attack those teachers who had demonstrated less than revolutionary zeal or had been unkind to students. Jianhua felt compelled to join the campaign, but this was difficult. He happened to like almost all of his teachers. He did not want to seem, however, like a revisionist. Besides, he respected the wisdom and authority of Mao. He decided to make a poster attacking teacher Wen, who had criticized him once for not being sufficiently interested in politics, which had bothered him at the time. He made his criticism of her as gentle as possible. Others took this up and went further with their attacks on teacher Wen, and Jianhua felt bad. To satisfy the students' growing anger, some teachers began to confess to some minor revolutionary sins, but this made the students feel they were hiding even more. They had to apply more pressure to get them to reveal the truth, and a student nicknamed Little Ba Wang, Ba Wang meaning overseer, referring to his love of giving orders, had an idea on how to do this. He had read Mao's description of how, during the revolution in the 1940s, peasants had captured the most notorious landlords and paraded them through their villages with enormous dunce caps on their heads and heavy wooden boards with inscriptions describing their crimes hung around their necks. To avoid such public humiliation, certainly the teachers would come clean and confess. The students agreed to try this, and their first target for such treatment was to be Teacher Li, Jianhua's favorite. Teacher Li was accused of faking his switch to communism. Stories began to come out of his telling other teachers about his visits to brothels in Shanghai. Clearly he had a secret life, and Jianhua now felt disappointed in Li. China before the Communist Revolution had been a cruel place, and if Li was working to bring that back, he could only hate him. Unwilling to confess to any crimes, Li was the first to be paraded through school, with the dunce cap and board around his neck. Along the way, some students poured a bucket of poster paste over his head. Jianhua followed the parade from a distance, trying to repress his uneasiness at the humiliation of his teacher. Led by Little Ba Wang, the students imposed the same fate on more teachers, the dunce caps becoming unbearably tall and the boards heavier. Imitating their revolutionary brothers and sisters in Beijing, the students initiated struggle meetings in which they forced certain teachers into the jet plane position, a student standing on either side, pushing teachers to their knees, pulling their hair back with a jerk, then holding their arms out and back like the wings of a jet plane. It was a most painful position, but it seemed to work, as after an hour or two of this, with students jeering at them, many teachers began to confess. The students were right in their suspicions. The school had been teeming with revisionists right under their noses. Soon the students' attention turned to the vice principal, Lin Shun, who they discovered was the son of a notorious landlord. He was the third highest official at school, which made this bit of news all the more salacious. Jianhua had been sent to his office once for misbehavior, and Shun had been quite lenient with him, which he had appreciated at the time. The students locked Lin Shun in a room, where he was to stay between the struggle meetings. But one morning, Jianhua, serving as the guard on duty, opened the room to discover the vice principal had hung himself. Once again, Jianhua struggled to repress his discomfort, but he had to admit the suicide made it seem as if Lin Shun was indeed guilty of something. One day, in the midst of all this, Jianhua ran into Fang Pu, who was bursting with excitement. Since his forced public apology over his poster attacking Ding, he had been laying low. He had spent his time devouring the writings of Mao and Marx and plotting his next move. Word had come from Beijing that the work teams were to be withdrawn from all schools. Students were to form their own committee, choose a school official to be its head, and run the school itself through the committee. Fang Pu planned on becoming the student leader of the committee, and he was going to wage open revolution against Secretary Ding. Jianhua could only admire his bravery and persistence. Through little Bao Wang, who had forced more and more confessions from teachers, Fang Pu learned that Secretary Ding had had affairs with at least two female teachers, revealing his audacious hypocrisy. He was the one continually ranting against Western decadence and was always admonishing the male and female students at Yizhen to keep their distance from each other. Bao Wang and Fang Pu ransacked his office and found that he had been hoarding food coupons and possessed a fancy radio and bottles of nice wine, all hidden away. Now posters attacking Ding filled the walls. Even Jianhua felt indignant at his behavior. Soon, Ding Yi was paraded through school and then through the town of Yizhen, on his head the most enormous dunce cap, decorated with drawings of monsters, and a very heavy drum hung around his neck. As he drummed with one hand while holding the cap with the other, he had to chant, "I am Ding Yi, ox demon and snake spirit." Citizens of Yizhen, who knew Secretary Ding, gaped at the spectacle. The world had indeed been turned upside down. By the middle of the summer, most of the teachers had fled. When it came time to form the committee to run the school, only a few remained to serve as chairman of the committee, and with Fang Pu as the student leader, a little-known and rather harmless teacher named Deng Zheng was named chairman. Now the work team left YMS, and Deng and the committee were in charge. As the students progressed in making revolution, Jianhua began to feel increasingly excited. He and his friend Song Wei carried old spears and swords as they patrolled the school looking for spies, and it was just like in the novels he loved to read. He and the other students marched in columns into town, waving enormous red flags, carrying large posters of Chairman Mao and copies of his little red book, chanting slogans, banging on drums, and crashing cymbals. It was so dramatic, and it felt like they were indeed participating in revolution. One day, they marched through Yizhen, tearing down store and street signs that were vestiges of pre-revolutionary China. Mao would be proud of them. In Beijing, some students had formed groups to support and defend Mao in his cultural revolution. They called themselves Red Guards, and their members wore bright red armbands. Mao gave his personal approval to this, and now Red Guard units began to appear in schools and universities around the country. Only the purest and most fervent revolutionaries could be admitted to the Red Guards, and competition was fierce to join their ranks. Because of his father's illustrious past, Jianhua became a member of the Red Guards, and now he basked in the admiring glances of fellow students and local citizens who noticed the bright red armband that never left him. There was one wrinkle, however, in these exciting events. On a visit home to see his family in the nearby town of Lingji, Jianhua discovered that local students had accused his father of being a revisionist. He cared more about farming and economics than about making revolution, said the students. They had gotten him dismissed from his government position. He had had to suffer through various struggle meetings in the jet plane position. The family was in disgrace. Although he loved and admired his father and worried for him, he could not help but feel anxious that if news of this disgrace reached his school, he might lose his red armband and be ostracized. He would have to be careful when talking about his family. When he returned to school several weeks later, he noticed some radical changes that had already occurred. Fang Pu had consolidated power. He had formed a new group called the East is Red Corps. He and his team had kicked out Chairman Deng and were now running the school themselves. They had started their own newspaper called Battlefield News to promote and defend their actions. Jianhua also learned that another teacher had died under suspicious circumstances. One day, Fang Pu visited Jianhua and invited him to be a star reporter for Battlefield News. Fang Pu looked different. He had put on weight, was not so pale, and was trying to grow a beard. It was a tempting offer from his friend, but something made Jianhua put him off, and Fang Pu did not like this, although he tried to disguise his annoyance with a forced smile. Fang Pu was beginning to frighten Jianhua. Students were now joining the East is Red Corps en masse, but within a few weeks a rival group, calling themselves the Red Rebels, emerged on campus. Their leader was Meng Jie, a student whose parents were peasants and who advocated revolution that was more tolerant, based on reason and not violence, which he felt was the purer form of Maoism. He gained some adherents, including Jianhua's older brother, Wei Hua, who was a student at YMS. Meng Jie's growing popularity infuriated Fang Pu. He called him a royalist, a sentimentalist, and secret counter-revolutionary. He and his followers destroyed the Red Rebel's office and threatened to do worse. It would certainly cause a complete rift with Fang Pu, but Jianhua contemplated joining the Red Rebels. He was attracted to their idealism. Just as the tension between the two sides was escalating into outright war, a representative from the Chinese military arrived on campus and announced that the army was now in charge. Mao had dispatched army units throughout the country to take control of schools. The increasing chaos and violence that was engulfing YMS was going on all over China, not only in schools but in factories and government offices as well. The Cultural Revolution was spinning out of control. Soon 36 soldiers arrived on campus, part of an army unit known as the 901. They ordered that all factions disband and that classes resume. There would be military drilling and discipline would be reestablished. Too much had changed, however, in the 8 months since this had all begun. The students could not accept such a sudden return to discipline. They sulked and did not turn up at classes. Fang Pu took charge of the campaign to get rid of the soldiers. He put up posters accusing the 901 of being enemies of the Cultural Revolution. One day, he and his followers attacked one of the army officers with a slingshot and wounded him. Just as the students feared reprisals, the 901 unit was suddenly recalled from campus without any explanation. The students were now completely on their own, and it seemed a frightening prospect. They quickly allied themselves with one of the two groups. Some joined the East is Red Corps because it was larger and offered better positions. Others joined the Red Rebels because they hated Fang Pu and Little Ba Wang. And others thought one group or the other was more revolutionary. Jianhua joined the Red Rebels, as did his friend, Zhong Wei. Each side felt certain it represented the true spirit of the Cultural Revolution, and as they yelled at one another and argued, fistfights broke out, and there was nobody to stop them. Soon students were bringing bats and sticks to the fights, and the injuries mounted. One day, some members of the East is Red Corps captured some Red Rebels and held them prisoners. The Red Rebels could not find out anything about their fate. In the middle of this tense moment, the Red Rebels discovered that one of their members, a female student named Yulun, was actually a spy for the other side. Infuriated by such tactics, they tied Yulun up and began to beat her to find out if there were more spies. Much to the dismay of Jianhua, who considered this a betrayal of their ideals, they battered and bruised her, but she revealed nothing. Soon Yulun was exchanged for the prisoners held by the East is Red Corps, but now the antipathy between the two sides had reached a breaking point. A few weeks later, the East is Red Corps suddenly left school en masse and established their headquarters in a building in town that they seized. Meng Jie decided to form a team of guerrilla fighters who would operate in Yizhen at night to keep an eye on the Corps and do some sabotage work. Jianhua was assigned to them as a reporter. It was an exciting job. As they encountered the enemy in town, battles with slingshots erupted. Then the Corps captured one of the rebel guerrillas, named He Ping. A few days later, he was discovered in a hospital, dead. The Corps had taken him for a ride in a jeep in the desert with a sock in his mouth, and he had suffocated along the way. Now, even Meng Jie had had enough and vowed revenge for this horrible deed. Jianhua could only agree with him. As the skirmishes spread throughout the town, citizens fled and entire buildings were abandoned and looters scoured them for goods. The Red Rebels were soon on the offensive. Working with local craftsmen, they manufactured the highest quality swords and spears. Casualties mounted. Finally, the rebels encircled the Corps' stronghold in town and prepared for a final offensive. The Corps fled, leaving behind a small band of student soldiers in the building. The rebels demanded their surrender, and suddenly, from a third-floor window, there was the young student, Yu Lun, screaming out, "I'd rather die than surrender to you." With the Corps' bright red flag in her hand, she shouted, "Long live Chairman Mao," and jumped. Jianhua found her lifeless body wrapped up in the flag on the ground. Her devotion to the cause astounded and impressed him. Now in control, the Red Rebels established their headquarters at the school and prepared their defenses for a counteroffensive from the Corps. They built a makeshift munitions factory on campus. Some students had learned how to make grenades and various powerful explosive devices. An inadvertent explosion killed several of them, but the work went on. Song Wei, the artist, had had enough. Somehow the noble origins of the Red Rebels had been lost, and he feared the expanding violence. He fled Yizhen for good. Jianhua lost respect for his friend. How could Song Wei forget those who had been injured or died for their cause? To give up now would be to say it was all in vain. He would not be a coward like his friend. Besides, the East's Red Corps was downright evil and was capable of doing anything to take power. They had betrayed the revolution. As life at the school settled down and the Red Rebels built up their defenses, Jianhua visited his family, whom he had not seen for a while. When he finally returned one night to school, however, he could not believe his eyes. His Red Rebel comrades were nowhere in sight. Their flag was no longer flying above the school. Everywhere there were armed soldiers. Finally, he found a few comrades hiding in a school building, and they told him what had happened. Mao was reasserting his authority once and for all. He was picking sides in various local conflicts to help create some order, and the military in the county had come down on the side of the East's Red Corps as the more truly revolutionary group. The repercussions of this could be awful. Jianhua and several other comrades decided they would try to escape and regroup in the mountains, where Meng Jie had apparently fled, but there was a blockade throughout the county and they were forced back to school, which had become more of a prison, overseen by the East's Red Corps. Now the rebels could only expect the worst. To the Corps, they were a bunch of counter-revolutionaries who had beaten and killed their comrades. Then, one day, as the Red Rebel members on campus were huddled together in a room, the leaders of the East's Red Corps, including Feng Pu and Little Ba Wang, entered with grenades tied to their belts. Feng Pu carried a blacklist of all those who were to be taken from the room, clearly for some nefarious purpose. Feng Pu appeared friendly toward Jianhua and told him it was not too late to change sides, but Jianhua could no longer see Feng Pu in the same light. His friendliness made him seem even more sinister. That night, they could hear the screams of their blacklisted comrades from another building. Then, news reached them that Corps members had found Meng Jie, beaten him up, and marched him back to school, where he was under arrest as well. In the room next to where Jianhua and his friends now slept, they observed Little Ba Wang and his team covering the windows with blankets. They were transforming it into a torture chamber. Soon they noticed former Red Rebels limping about on campus, afraid to talk to anyone. Then it was Jianhua's turn to be taken into the room. He was blindfolded and tied to a chair in a most uncomfortable position. They wanted him to sign a withdrawal statement, and as he hesitated to do so, they began to beat him with a chair leg. Jianhua screamed, "You can't do this to me. We're classmates. We're all class brothers." Little Ba Wang would have none of this. Jianhua had to confess his crimes, the part he had played in the various battles in town, and name names of other Red Rebels hiding somewhere on campus. The blows on his legs became more intense, and then they began to hit him over the head. Still blindfolded, he feared for his life and in a panic suddenly spilled the name of a fellow Red Rebel, Du Su. Finally, they carried Jianhua, unable to walk, out of the room. He quickly felt intense regret that he had named Du Su. What a coward he had been. He tried to warn Du Su, but it was too late. The torturing of other Red Rebels continued in the room next door, including his brother Wei Hua, beaten to a bloody pulp. Meng Zhe had his head shaved, and when they saw him next, his face was covered in the most hideous bruises. One day, Jianhua was told his old friend and comrade, Zhong Wei, had been captured, and when Jianhua went to see him, he was unconscious, his bare legs full of large punctures, blood oozing everywhere. They had flailed him with steel hooks for refusing to admit his crimes. How could the rather harmless Zhong Wei inspire such savagery? Jianhua ran to get the doctor, but when they returned, it was too late. Zhong Wei died in his friend's arms. The dead body was quickly carted away and a cover story was created for how he had died. Jianhua was ordered to remain silent. A female teacher who refused to affirm in an affidavit the official East is Red Corps version of his death was beaten and gang-raped by Little Ba Wang and his followers. In the months to come, Fang Pu extended his powers everywhere, as he essentially ran the school and classes resumed. Battlefield News was the only newspaper allowed. The school itself had been renamed East is Red Middle School. With the Corps' power secure, the torture chamber was dismantled. Classes largely consisted of reciting quotes from Mao. Every morning they assembled before a giant poster of Chairman Mao and, brandishing their little red books, chanted to his long life. The East is Red members began a scrupulous rewriting of the past. They held an exhibition to celebrate their victories, full of doctored photographs and fake news reports, all to bolster their side of events. An enormous statue of Chairman Mao, 5 times larger than life, was now installed at the school gate, towering over everything else. The former members of the Red Rebels had to wear white armbands that described their various crimes. They were made to kowtow before the Mao statue several times a day while classmates kicked them from behind. The former Red Rebels had become like the reviled teachers, cowed and obedient. Jianhua was forced to do the most menial labor, and having had enough of this, in early summer of 1968 he returned to his hometown. His father sent him and his brother to a farm deep in the mountains where they could be safe and work as laborers. In September, determined to finish his studies, Jianhua returned to school. The few months away had given him some perspective, and now when he looked at the East is Red Middle School, it appeared in a very different light. Everywhere he saw signs of unbelievable destruction. Classrooms completely torn up with no desks or chairs, the walls full of peeling posters and crumbling plaster. The science labs devoid of all equipment, piles of rubble around the campus, unmarked graves, the music hall blown up by a bomb, and hardly a reputable teacher or official left to resume their education. All of this destruction in a few short years. And for what? What did He Ping and Yu Lun and Zhong Wei and so many others die for? What had they been fighting over? What had they learned? He could no longer figure it out, and the waste of their young lives filled him with disgust and despair. Soon Jianhua and his brother joined the army to escape the school and bury their memories. Over the following years, as he drove an army truck delivering stone and cement, he and his comrades watched the slow disassembling of the Cultural Revolution, all of its former leaders falling into disgrace. After the death of Mao in 1976, the Communist Party itself finally condemned the Cultural Revolution as a national catastrophe. Interpretation. The previous story and characters come from the book Born Red, 1987, by Gao Wan. After the Cultural Revolution, the author changed his name from Gao Jianhua to Gao Wan. It is his non-fiction account of the events he participated in at his school during the Cultural Revolution. In essence, the Cultural Revolution was Mao's attempt to try to alter human nature itself. According to Mao, through millennia of capitalism in various forms, humans had become individualistic and conservative, bound to their social class. Mao wanted to wipe the slate clean and start over. As he explained it, a clean sheet of paper has no blotches, and so the newest and most beautiful pictures can be painted on it. To get his blank canvas, Mao would have to shake things up on a mass scale by uprooting old habits and ways of thinking and by eradicating people's mindless respect for those in authority. Once he accomplished this, Mao could start to paint something bold and new on the clean sheet. The result would be a fresh generation that could begin to forge a classless society not weighed down by the past. The events depicted in Born Red reveal in a microcosm the result of Mao's experiment. How human nature cannot be uprooted. Try to alter it, and it merely reemerges in different shapes and forms. The results of hundreds of thousands of years of evolution and development cannot be radically re-engineered by some scheme, particularly when it involves the behavior of humans in groups, which inevitably conforms to certain ancient patterns. Although it might be tempting to see what happened at YMS as mostly relevant to group adolescent behavior, young people often represent human nature in a more naked and purer form than adults, who are cleverer at disguising their motivations. In any case, what happened at the school occurred throughout China, in government offices, factories, within the army, and among Chinese of all ages, in an eerily similar way. Here's exactly how Mao's experiment failed, and what it shows about human nature. Mao had the following specific strategy to enact his bold idea. Focus people's attention on a legitimate enemy, in this case, revisionists, those who consciously or unconsciously were clinging to the past. Encourage people, particularly the young, to actively fight against this reactionary force, but also against any entrenched forms of authority. In struggling against these conservative enemies, the Chinese would be able to free themselves from old patterns of thinking and acting. They would finally get rid of elites and ranking systems, and they would unify as a revolutionary class with utmost clarity as to what they were fighting for. His strategy, however, had a fatal flaw at its core. When people operate in groups, they do not engage in nuanced thinking and deep analysis. Only individuals with a degree of calmness and detachment can do so. People in groups feel emotional and excited. Their primary desire is to fit into the group spirit. Their thinking tends to be simplistic, good versus evil, with us or against us. They naturally look for some type of authority to simplify matters for them. Deliberately creating chaos, as Mao did, only makes the group more certain to fall into these primitive patterns of thinking, since it is too frightening for humans to live with too much confusion and uncertainty. Look at how the students at YMS responded to Mao's call for action. When first confronted with the Cultural Revolution, they merely transformed Mao himself into the new authority to guide them. They swallowed his ideas with very little personal reflection. They imitated the actions of others in Beijing in the most conventional way. Looking for revisionists, they tended to base their judgments on appearances. The clothes the teachers wore, the special food or wine they drank, their manners, their family background. Such appearances could be quite deceptive. Teacher Wen was radical in her beliefs, but was judged a revisionist based on her fondness for Western-style fashion. In the old order, the students were supposed to give total obedience to their all-powerful teachers. Suddenly freed from all that, they remained just as emotionally tied to the past. The teachers still seemed all-powerful, but now as scheming counter-revolutionaries. The students' repressed resentment at having to be so obedient now boiled over into anger and the desire to be the ones doing the punishing and oppressing. When the teachers confessed to crimes they mostly had never committed to avoid the escalating punishments, that only seemed to confirm the students in their paranoia. They had shifted roles from obedient students to oppressors, but their thinking had become even more simplistic and irrational, the opposite of Mao's intentions. In the power vacuum that Mao had now created, another timeless group dynamic emerged. Those who were naturally more assertive, aggressive, and even sadistic, in this case Fang Pu and Little Ba Wang, pushed their way forward and assumed power, while those who were more passive, Jian Hua, Zong Wei, quietly receded into the background, becoming followers. The aggressive types at YMS now formed a new class of elites, doling out perks and privileges. Similarly, amid all the confusion the Cultural Revolution had spawned, the students became even more obsessed with status within the group. Who was in the red category among them, and who in the black, they wondered. Was it better now to come from the peasantry or the proletariat? How could they finagle membership in the Red Guards and garner that beautiful red armband that signified revolutionary elite status? Instead of naturally inclining toward a new egalitarian order, the students kept straining to occupy superior positions. Once all forms of authority were removed and the students ran the school, there was nothing to stop the next and most dangerous development in group dynamics, the split into tribal factions. By nature, we humans reject attempts by anyone to completely monopolize power, as Fang Pu tried to do. This cuts off opportunities for other ambitious, aggressive people. It also creates large groupings in which individual members can feel somewhat lost. Almost automatically, groups will split into rival, smaller factions and tribes. In the rival tribe, a new charismatic leader, Meng Jie in this case, can assume power and members can identify more easily with the smaller number of comrades. The bonds are tight and made even tighter by the struggle against the tribal enemy. People may think they are joining because of the different ideas or goals of this tribe or the other, but what they want more than anything is the sense of belonging and a clear tribal identity. Look at the actual differences between the East is Red Corps and the Red Rebels. As the battle between them intensified, it was hard to say what they were fighting for, except to assume power over the other group. One strong or vicious act of one side called for a reprisal from the other, and any type of violence seemed totally justified. There could be no middle ground, nor any questioning of the rightness of their cause. The tribe is always right, and to say otherwise is to betray it, as Zong Wei did. Mao had wanted to forge a unified Chinese citizenry, clear as to its goals, and instead the entire country descended into tribal battles completely disconnected from the original purpose of the Cultural Revolution. To make matters worse, the crime rate soared and the economy had ground to a halt, as hardly anyone felt compelled to work or manufacture anything. The masses had become even lazier and more resentful than under the old order. By the spring of 1968, Mao's only recourse was to install a police state. Hundreds of thousands were thrown into prisons. The army virtually took over. To help restore order and respect for authority, Mao converted himself into a cult figure, his image to be worshipped and his words to be repeated like revolutionary prayers. It is interesting to note how Fang Pu's form of repression at YMS, the torture, the rewriting of history, the control of all media, mirrored what Mao was doing throughout the country. The new revolutionary society that Mao and Fang Pu had wanted now actually resembled the most repressive, superstitious regimes of feudal China. As Jian Hua's father, a victim of the Cultural Revolution himself, kept telling his son, "A thing turns into its opposite if pushed too far." Understand. We will tend to imagine that this story is an extreme example that has little relevance to our own lives and the groups we belong to. After all, we navigate through worlds full of sophisticated people in high-tech offices where everyone is seemingly so polite and civilized. We see ourselves in a similar way. We have our progressive ideals and our independent thinking, but much of this is an illusion. If we looked at ourselves closely and honestly, we would have to admit that the moment we enter our workspace or any group, we undergo a change. We easily slip into more primitive modes of thinking and behaving without realizing it. Around others, we naturally tend to feel insecure as to what they think of us. We feel pressure to fit in, and to do so, we begin to shape our thoughts and beliefs to the group orthodoxies. We unconsciously imitate others in the group in appearances, verbal expressions, and ideas. We tend to worry a lot about our status and where we rank in the hierarchy. Am I getting as much respect as my colleagues? This is the primate part of our nature, as we share this obsession with status with our chimpanzee relatives. Depending on patterns from early childhood, in the group setting we become more passive or more aggressive than usual, revealing the less developed sides of our character. When it comes to leaders, we generally don't see them as ordinary people. We tend to feel somewhat awed and intimidated in their presence, as if they possessed some mythical extra powers. When we contemplate our group's main rival or enemy, we can't help but get a little heated and angry and exaggerate any negative qualities. If others in the group are feeling anxious or outraged by something, we often get swept up in the group mood. All of these are subtle indications that we are under the influence of the group. If we are experiencing the aforementioned transformations, we can be sure the same is going on with our colleagues. Now imagine some outside threat to our group's well-being or stability, a crisis of sorts. All of the previously mentioned reactions would be intensified by the stress, and our apparently civilized, sophisticated group could become quite volatile. We would feel greater pressure to prove our loyalty and go along with anything the group advocated. Our thinking about the rival, enemy, would become even more simplistic and heated. We would be subject to more powerful waves of viral emotions, including panic or hatred or grandiosity. Our group could split up into factions with tribal dynamics. Charismatic leaders could easily emerge to exploit this volatility. If pushed far enough, the potential for aggression lies under the surface of almost any group. But even if we hold back from overt violence, the primitive dynamic that takes over can have grave consequences, as the group overreacts and makes decisions based on exaggerated fears or uncontrollable excitement. To resist this downward pull that groups inevitably exert on us, we must conduct a very different experiment in human nature from Mao's, with a simple goal in mind: to develop the ability to detach ourselves from the group and create some mental space for true independent thinking. We begin this experiment by accepting the reality of the powerful effect that the group has on us. We are brutally honest with ourselves, aware of how our need to fit in can shape and warp our thinking. Does that anxiety or sense of outrage that we feel come completely from within, or is it inspired by the group? We must observe our tendency to demonize the enemy and control it. We must train ourselves to not blindly venerate our leaders. We respect them for their accomplishments without feeling the need to deify them. We must be especially careful around those who have charismatic appeal and try to demystify and pull them down to earth. With such awareness, we can begin to resist and detach. As part of this experiment, we must not only accept human nature, but work with what we have to make it productive. We inevitably feel the need for status and recognition, so let's not deny it. Instead, let's cultivate such status and recognition through our excellent work. We must accept our need to belong to the group and prove our loyalty, but let's do it in more positive ways. By questioning group decisions that will harm it in the long run, by supplying divergent opinions, by steering the group in a more rational direction, gently and strategically. Let's use the viral nature of emotions in the group, but play on a different set of emotions. By staying calm and patient, by focusing on results and cooperating with others to get practical things done, we can begin to spread this spirit throughout the group. And by slowly mastering the primitive part of our character within the heated environment of the group, we can emerge as individuals who are truly independent and rational, the end point of our experiment. When people are free to do as they please, they usually imitate each other. Eric Hoffer. Keys to Human Nature. At certain moments in life, we humans may experience an energy that is powerful with sensations unlike any other, but this energy is something we rarely discuss or analyze. We can describe it as an intense feeling of belonging to a group, and we